Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. One of the best things about BetterHelp is that treatment is discreet and convenient. I know that especially in a small town, it might be difficult to find treatment, or it may be intimidating because small town gossip spreads like wildfire. You shouldn't feel judged for seeking help with your mental health. But if that's what's been holding you back, fear not, BetterHelp is here to save the day. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anyone on camera unless you want to. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can start communicating with your therapist in under 48 hours. And thanks to the great people at BetterHelp, I have a special offer for Obscure History listeners. You can get 10% off your first month of professional therapy at betterhelp.com/obscure. That's betterhelp.com/obscure. Thanks again to BetterHelp for sponsoring this episode. Dating is hard. I mean, I assume it's hard. I've been happily married for basically my entire adult life. But I am on social media, and I see how things have changed in the last few years. The last time I dated somebody, aside from my wife, we were still scratching out two-sentence text messages on our flip phones. Certainly, social media existed, and I could chat with my friends and potential suitors on MySpace, but it was nothing like today. If you're feeling overwhelmed by trying to learn dating etiquette in our increasingly digital world, don't fear. Dating has always been very, very complicated. My name is Josh, and this is Obscure History. If you're hoping for some dating advice, this is the wrong podcast for you. My wife and I got married about a month after we turned 20 and have been enjoying our shared lives ever since. In fact, I might be the absolute worst person to get dating advice from, especially in this new scene. It seems that there is a hot new dating app released on the daily, each bearing their own etiquette and feel. In fact, according to Pew Research, while 48% of 18 to 29-year-olds say that they have ever used a dating site or app, the share is 38% among those ages 30 to 49, and even lower for those over 50. At the same time, personal experiences with online dating greatly differ by sexual orientation. Lesbian, gay, or bisexual adults are roughly twice as likely than those who are straight to say that they've ever used a dating platform, 55% to 28%. The data shows that online dating platforms are indeed very popular. But do they help? The research continues. By a wide margin, Americans who have used dating sites or apps in the past year say their recent experience left them feeling more frustrated than hopeful. Other sentiments are more evenly balanced between positive and negative feelings. Some 35% of current or recent users say that in the past year, online dating has made them feel more pessimistic, while 29% say these platforms left them feeling more optimistic. Similarly, 32% say online dating sites or apps made them feel more confident, whereas 25% say it left them feeling more insecure. Those are pretty dour responses, and we're just talking about getting a date. As if that isn't complicated enough, there is still the matter of actually going on the date and acting appropriately. As I obviously don't have experience with this, I had to turn to the internet to see what that's supposed to be like in a post-pandemic 2022. And what I found was incredibly confusing. Dozens of new-to-me terms like woke fishing, cuffing, love-bombing, orbiting, and breadcrumbing make dating seem like an entire SAT category. So, perhaps you're wondering why we started here, a married man trying to understand post-pandemic dating culture. Well, I recently stumbled upon a very interesting story about the trials and tribulations of dating. After the United States got involved in World War I, American citizens faced very familiar wartime shortages. Consumer products like food, Stamps and home goods were rationed, and those on the home front of the war were asked to make sacrifices whenever they were able. Michigan State University notes that rationing and buying bonds became the number one way that everyday Americans could support the war effort and the soldiers fighting overseas in Europe. The National Food Garden Commission encouraged families to expand their gardens and grow not only for their household, but for their country. A nation at war is a nation with a food problem. A nation with a food shortage is a nation in peril, they said. Women were entered in contests and praised in magazines for their hard work and gardening achievements that benefited the war effort. Headlines like, "Are you trying for the war savings stamp prizes offered by the commission?" encouraged Americans to get better at gardening and canning their crops by showing women who have been successful despite being novice gardeners. The National War Garden Commission published a free book titled, "Home Canning and Drying of Vegetables and Fruits." The book not only served as a resource for those starting their own war garden, but it also provided testimonials of experienced gardeners and step-by-step instructions on how to care for numerous fruits and vegetables. Another product that was rationed was gasoline. And in response to the gasoline shortage, motorists were encouraged to rideshare. This idea was prudent and reasonable, but there were a couple of very negative and unforeseen consequences. First, it gave birth to a somewhat predatory practice called the jitney. MIT research revealed that in the summer of 1914, the U.S. economy fell into recession with the outbreak of World War I, and some entrepreneurial vehicle owners in Los Angeles began to pick up streetcar passengers in exchange for a jitney, the 5-cent streetcar fare. The jitney idea spread incredibly rapidly. By December 1914, merely 6 months after the idea was believed to have been conceived, Los Angeles had issued 1,520 chauffeur licenses for jitney operation. In San Francisco, the jitneys first appeared in 1914 and were first used to transport workers and attendees to the 1914-1915 Panama Pacific International Exposition. By 1915, over 1,400 jitneys were operating in San Francisco, with the first jitneys beginning service in Portland, Maine in March 1915. The jitney craze had spread from the west to the east in 9 months. Jitney use was not without trade-offs. Jitney drivers were known to drive aggressively and accidents were frequent, with passengers standing on the back of vehicles and on the running boards. Serious injuries did occur. The transport of female passengers raised concerns in some social circles. At its peak, it is estimated that nearly 75,000 jitney drivers were operating in the United States at any given time. The second unintended consequence of World War I ride-sharing was that most of the people who were left on the home front were women, and many of those women would find themselves ride-sharing with men that they probably didn't know. This wasn't ideal because it put a lot of women into very uncomfortable positions. And despite the very awkward and compromising positions they were put in, the women of World War I America persisted, and eventually the war ended. Many couples were reconnected when the men came home, and food and home goods were no longer rationed. There was also no longer a gas shortage, so women were no longer encouraged to share rides with random men. But sometimes things take a while to go back to normal. But before we get to that, we need to stop and pay the bills. If you want ad-free episodes with bonus content, hit the subscribe button on Apple Podcasts. If you want to chat with me and other like-minded history nerds completely for free, then join our Discord server. It's free and it's fun. The link will be in the show notes. After the boys returned from the war, life began to return to normal. However, things changed slowly, and men were still trying to pick up women to ride-share, even though it was no longer encouraged or required. The post-war women didn't find this behavior very flattering, and instead felt offended that the post-war men were still trying to put them in compromising positions. So one woman decided to put an end to it once and for all. In 1923, Alice Riley drafted up the charter and rules for a club called the Anti-Flirt Club. She, along with 9 others, celebrated the first Anti-Flirt Week beginning on March 5th of that year. Unfortunately, due to societal roles of the day, they couldn't directly target the behavior of the men who were causing problems, so they instead targeted women and shared tips and tricks to avoid unwanted attention from men. They invited other women to join the club under the condition that they follow the club's 10-rule structure. They went something like this. Don't flirt. Those who flirt in haste often repent in leisure. Don't accept rides from flirting motorists. They don't invite you in to save you a walk. Don't use your eyes for ogling. They were made for worthier purposes. Don't go out with men you don't know. They may be married and you may be in for a hair-pulling match. Don't wink. A flutter in one eye may cause a tear in the other. Don't smile at flirtatious strangers. Save them for people you know. Don't annex all the men you can get. By flirting with many, you may lose out on the one. Don't fall for the slick, dandified cake-eater. The unpolished gold of a real man is worth more than the gloss of a lounge lizard. Don't let elderly men with an eye to a flirtation pat you on the shoulder and take fatherly interest in you. Those are usually the kind who want to forget they are fathers. Don't ignore the man you are sure of while you flirt with another. When you return to the first one, you may find him gone. Now, interestingly, it seems as if the movement caught on, at least initially. Recruitment articles began appearing in newspapers across the nation, like this one from the Huntsville News in Alabama. What are you going to do about it, girls? This query is being put here following the announcement from Washington that someone has organized the Anti-Flirt Club. The suggestion is made that the pretty young things may not be able to take care of themselves in the face of the advances of scheming he-vamps who seek to entice them to the corner of the drugstore without an introduction. And this someone proposes that an organization be formed to combat the curbstone loafers, the wicked-eye motorist, and the conceited mashers so that they will cease their machinations on the helpless young innocents. What do you think about an anti-flirt club for Huntsville girls, and how would you like to belong to it? It goes without saying that young women of today boast that they can take care of themselves and do not need advice of older sisters who lived a decade or so ago when it was the fad to wear trailing skirts down the street. But can she? The question resolves itself into two phases. There are two types of girls, one who seek the attention of the sterner sex, and this one who essentially should be admitted to membership in the Anti-Flirt Club, were one formed in the South. Let us take a peep at her as she goes tripping down the street in her high French heel to the tune of her trickling jade earbobs. She casts glances on either side when a scheming male lurks into sight. She puts on her sweetest smile. Then, lo, the spell has cast in some instances. At least the two walk away as genial companions. This type of girl might profit by such an organization. But would she join it? The other type of girl is one who can truly proclaim that she can protect herself from the designing males who loaf the street corners. She dresses modestly, and she does not cast sly glances to the right and to the left. She attends her own affairs while she is in the reach of so-called mashers, and if, as she rarely is, she is attacked by some sly smile from the schemers, she gives them the cold shoulder. Her appearance is her protection, and she is not subjugated to the rude insults that her less sensible sister invites. Well, it's up to you, girls. What do you think about an anti-flirt club in your home state? Or this spirited article from Oakland, California. See that wink? Well, that is all very well where it is, but just let a mere man try it, and this is what will happen to him. The anti-flirt club will get him if he don't watch out. The lovely lady behind the wink is not flirting with you. She is just putting on an animated demonstration of what no male masher may do and get away with. She's Miss Jackie Brunez, Century Theater leading woman, and she is the leading woman of the anti-flirt club too, for we unanimously elected her president right off the reel. You see, we girls decided the end must come to this everlasting embarrassment of having unknown and presuming men try to flirt with us, staring rudely, making fresh remarks, and actually winking at us on the street. So the other day we held a grand indignation and organization meeting, and as a result there's going to be something doing. We're going to stage a little old campaign that will make the Ruhr Valley disturbance look like a Sunday school picnic. We're going to gather our forces, and during the week of Monday, March 13th, we'll keep our eyes open for ogling mashers. It's going to be an unlucky date, and a blue Monday for them. For we don't intend to merely pass them by with a hurt look. Oh no. Visualize this little scene. Time. Any day, next week, on any street. Pretty member passing by. Masher casually winks an eye. Pardon me, haven't we met before? I can't say, sir, but I'd adore to saunter down the street a bit so you and I may speak of it. Well, cutie, what's the bill of fare? Just walk with me around the square. I'll introduce you to a friend of mine. I'm sure he'll cotton to your line. You know, I feel you two really should meet. He's the policeman on his beat. Officer, here's a mashing pest. I'll leave you. He needs a rest. That's the way the anti-flirt club works. So girls, now's the time to get up your fighting spirit and join. If you've had the embarrassing experience of the masher's attentions on the street corners or in automobiles or in streetcars, you're qualified for membership in the anti-flirt club. And you are not only privileged, but urged to cooperate with all of us irate flirt eradicators, and will countenance most any working method you can devise and beneficially carry out. Miss Brunia says, I'm for the club and the campaign. A girl goes jauntily down the street. The world is a joyful place, and she smiles with the sheer pleasure of being alive. And who wants to see a girl wearing a soured-on-life face? But just because all life to her seems sweet and fresh is no sign to the masher that she should fall in line and be ditto. And Miss Brunia says further, just because a girl is on the stage, some men seem to think they are privileged to make familiar remarks to her as she leaves the theater. As president of the Anti-Flirt Club, I'll be right on hand for the campaign launching next Monday, and woe to the unknown male who attempts a second look or a casual wink of the eye. Three cheers for our president as the Anti-Flirt Club head. She has a book value with me, twice par. You should have been there when the club held its initial meeting. If the male flirt could have known all the dreadful things the members vowed to do to him, he'd either make his eyes behave or he'd vow to stay indoors during the campaign week. Here are some of the slogans adopted by enthusiastic members. Do they sound like business? Closed eye, closed fist. And I'll close his other eye too, viciously asserts the up-and-coming organizers of the slogan. Wink an eye and watch us work, is the threatening motto of a serious trio of high school seniors. And get this one. Mangle the Masher. That from an Oakland Athletic girl. There will doubtless be various methods of snuffing out the existence of the he-flirt and demonstration during the campaign. But the results will be the same. On with the campaign, and this is our warning to the Oakland Masher. Beware the ideas and eyes of March. The movement began to be reported on across the pond in the UK, and US congressmen even began to show their support for it. Former Congressman Herrick joins the Anti-Flirt Club talk. Washington, D.C. Manuel Herrick, ex-congressman from Oklahoma, who stirred the Capitol some months ago with his crusade to end beauty contests, today joined the Anti-Flirt Club, composed of pretty government workers. Herrick urged the girls to be strong of heart, grit your teeth, and forge ahead in your righteous cause. He warned them to beware of the young men who ask girls to go on automobile rides. Remember that all young men who ask a young lady to ride in a machine do not do it simply to save her a walk, he said. When I read your noble work on putting down the masher, I could not resist coming out here to talk to you and advise you to put a little pepper into your organization and to expect to have to fight a powerful foe. Your ideal is a high and noble one, and if it can survive, it will be most helpful and should be aided, abetted, and commended. Strangely, it seems as if the movement died out suddenly. Despite garnering passionate interest from the public, the first Anti-Flirt Week was the only Anti-Flirt Week. Unfortunately, the last real reference to the Anti-Flirt Club appears in a cautionary tale from the Hamilton Evening Journal in Ohio. A new and tragic light was focused recently on that modern feminine peril, the masher. With the sudden and mysterious death of Mrs. Aurelia Fisher Dreyfus, wealthy Manhattan divorcee. Her death resulted in reopening the inquiry into the equally mysterious murder 7 years ago of the famous Broadway butterfly, Dorothy King. Both these beauties came to a violent end of a trail that began with pickup romance. The case of Mrs. Dreyfus might have been dismissed as just another suicide if it were not for the discovery that she was the mysterious blonde involved in Dot King's murder riddle. The story of their unhappy end aroused police, parents, welfare workers, and sociologists throughout the country in a renewed effort to wipe out the pickup evil. In most large cities of the United States, crusades have been started at one time or another against the automobile masher, the telephone masher, and other types of men who prey upon pretty, unescorted girls. The cases of Dorothy King and Mrs. Dreyfus are now held up as a warning of the fate that might befall any attractive young woman. Indeed, the story of Dorothy King might have been far different but for the harmless telephone flirtation. It began while Dot was trying to reach a friend on the phone. Until then, she was a young woman seeking fame and fortune on the stage. Here, the story of Dot King is interrupted by another famous pickup. Aurelia Fisher's life also would have taken a different turn, but for a traffic signal. While riding in her own automobile on Fifth Avenue, she was forced to stop because of a red light. Another car, also balked by the traffic signals, drew up alongside. The man in the other car smiled at her. She smiled back. There was a hurried conversation before the lights changed. Aurelia had accepted an invitation to attend a dance that night with the stranger. The man at the wheel was Edmund Joseph McBrien. The two became close friends. Theirs was a friendship that did not seem to be interrupted in the least, even when Aurelia Fisher was married to Herbert Dreyfus, a wealthy New York broker in October of 1923. But in 1924, the wealthy Herbert Dreyfus divorced Aurelia Fisher. She and McBrien, however, continued their friendship. The years passed, and perhaps Mrs. Dreyfus forgot about the past. One night last October, she came to the end of the road. It was during a swanky Potomac boat club dance in Washington. She was accompanied, as usual, by McBrien. The best of the Capital Society was there. Lights and music floated about her. But Mrs. Dreyfus was unhappy. Just why she was unhappy is yet to be cleared up. It is of the utmost importance to the police. But according to affidavits signed by members of her family, she told one of her sisters that she was afraid. While the rest of her family returned to the lights and music, Aurelia Dreyfus remained on the club's balcony. When they returned, she was not there, but her mangled body was found below. Her jewelry was found nearby. Now the authorities hope to determine just what was behind her fatal plunge. The grand jury intends to investigate until it is able to say whether she jumped or was pushed to her death. Regardless of the outcome, the startling lesson of her pickup romance remains. For, like Dorothy King, it led to tragedy. Recent investigations show that the masher is proving to be a menace throughout the country. There have been scores of cases in which young ladies who carelessly accepted rides or flirted over telephones have come to grief in the end. Newspaper headlines almost every week tell of attacks on girls. In Washington, where the case of Aurelia Dreyfus reached its unhappy climax, an anti-flirt club has been formed. Its members, composed of young girls, are pledged to refuse rides from strange motorists. The code of guidance urges girls not to flirt, not to accept rides, not to carry out telephone conversations with strange masculine voices. And that's where the trail runs cold. What started as a way to condemn the rideshare dating culture that was no longer necessary in post-World War I America evolved into a shield, a cautionary tale. Unfortunately, due to societal expectations, it was difficult for women to directly refute the actions of men at the time. So the anti-flirt club and similar actions focused on the behavior of women, despite them being the victims. Thank you for listening, everybody. I sincerely appreciate it. Now, this one was a bit of a wild ride. When I first found the articles, it was kind of like, look at this little quirky thing that I found on newspapers.com. And then the more articles that I found, the like more serious and disturbing the story became. And I didn't really intend for it to go that way, but sometimes you just have to follow the research wherever it will take you. The first few articles that I found, especially the ones around Washington, D.C., made the anti-flirt club seem kind of like a sort of a cheeky way to reestablish dating norms, you know, since the United States wasn't happening to ration gas anymore. As I started reading more and more of them, it turned into either like weirdly shaming women or like being very scary and like warning women that they were going to die if they got in a car with a man, which is sad because it was probably very true. But it was kind of a wild one to research. I really had kind of a hard time framing it in a way that made sense. That also kind of was in a narrative sort of progression. Hopefully it was okay. I've never really been this unsure about an episode, but I liked the story. The Anti-Flirt Club is a very interesting, unique little niche piece of United States history that I kind of like. As always, this episode is brought to you in part by Indie Drop-In Network and Earbuds Podcast Collective. Go check out those services if you are just hankering for something new and don't know where to look. Also, join the Discord. It is free. There's history memes. We laugh. We joke. I share details about upcoming episodes. You can even give me an episode idea if you'd like. I am going to be doing one that was suggested by somebody on the Discord server here soon. So it's definitely worth it. If you want to throw something out there, there's a pretty good chance that it might end up on the show someday. Anyways, you guys have a nice week. Thank you for listening.